It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Obama administration is set to name the countries that have been chosen for the Global Health Initiative. It aims to make better use of U.S. aid by helping poor countries improve health systems and focusing on mothers and children. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
The Obama administration's Global Health Initiative would work with poor countries to create health systems tailored to their needs. There's a concern that other basic health needs have been neglected in favor of AIDS. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health says that the initiative would provide $63 billion over 6 years,
which is the largest amount of money that has ever been committed to any global health initiative. It isn't only HIV that is in that program. There's maternal health, child health, neglected tropical diseases, nutrition, malaria, etc.
The initiative preserves the Bush AIDS Relief Plan and adds funding and assistance for 9 countries to build up basic health systems, among them Bangladesh, Mali, and Ethiopia. The aim is to allow patients to get care at one location rather than having to seek care in different places. For example, family planning at one facility and HIV care at another. But what worries AIDS advocates like Mark Harrington is when you look at the administration's budget for HIV/AIDS, the increases in coming years are not as steep as in previous years.
The resources available that have been proposed and put on the table by the White House are totally, grossly insufficient to achieve the vision of the president's own global health initiative.
Even though 5 million people in developing countries are being treated now, millions more are waiting.
There are no resources in the world right now that are going to treat every single person who needs to be treated.
Again, NIH's Dr. Anthony Fauci.
We definitely need to do more. And let me go on the record. I'm in total favor of universal access for everyone who's infected, who needs to be on therapy. Is that going to be feasible given the current resources? No, it's not. So we have a problem. And I think to deny that there's a problem is being unrealistic.
But one country where health officials say they are already seeing the effects of the administration's slowdown in funding for HIV/AIDS is Uganda. The country was considered an HIV/AIDS model during the Bush administration, but it's not on the list of countries being phased into the Global Health Initiative. Uganda's Dr. Peter Mugenyi says he's disturbed by this shift in international health.
We still have a crisis in Africa. The crisis is not over. The emergency is not over. We are not able to treat all those people who are coming to us in need of treatment. So clinics are turning away patients.
Mugenyi says Uganda has 170,000 people on anti-AIDS drugs, less than half of the people who need treatment now. Those already on treatment will continue to get the medicines. Mugenyi says when one person in a family is getting the drugs and another is being turned away from clinics, families face painful choices.
A woman just returned the drugs to me. She said she couldn't take the drugs herself when the rest of her family could not access treatment.
Similar stories are being told by Doctors Without Borders of HIV patients turned away from clinics in Malawi, Kenya, and South Africa. Experts say that in many cases, it's not that AIDS drugs are in short supply. There's a lack of coordination among clinics that provide treatment, a problem that Global Health Initiative hopes to address. More details of the Global Health Initiative are expected to be announced soon. But already the administration is on the ground in countries, merging U.S. programs like maternal and child health, family planning, malaria, and AIDS. Because fewer staff are required, money is being saved that can be used to provide services elsewhere. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Grand Bayou is a tiny fishing village of Native Americans located in the vast wetlands south of New Orleans. You can only get there by boat. Before the Cajuns, Spanish, French, and Americans came, the ancestors of the people of Grand Bayou were living in the marsh catching seafood, and they're still there. But now they're scared because of the Gulf oil spill and the way it's threatening their way of life. NPR's John Burnett has our story.
The people of Grand Bayou tend to stay put, like 66-year-old fisherman Raymond Reyes, with his shaggy white hair and a cross tattooed on his leathery brown bicep.
Why leave heaven and go to hell? This is heaven here, you know? I tried in Texas. I can't make it. All I see with cement, Mexicans. I don't care. I can't understand Mexican, and I don't like cement. I like water.
The water is their identity. They're surviving members of the Atakapa Ishak Indians, one of the small Native American tribes that still lives on the bayous and marshes of southeast Louisiana. While other marshmen have taken jobs in the oil and chemical industries, the people of Grand Bayou resolutely try to live as their forebears did, fishing, shrimping, oystering, hunting, and trapping. A flatboat appears carrying a woman wearing colorful jewelry and her hair in a long black braid. She is Rosina Philippe, the 54-year-old spokeswoman for the village.
Welcome to summertime in Louisiana.
Her brother, Danny Dean, who wears a straw hat against the punishing sun, guns the outboard. The little skiff noses into a placid canal lined with storm-wrecked houses and just a few habitable ones.
This is Grand Bayou, the village, and these are some of the homes damaged during Hurricane Katrina.
Before Katrina, there were 23 extended families living in Grand Bayou. The hurricane's epic tide and wind decimated the little fishing outpost. Grand Bayou had just begun to get back on its feet when the oil spill happened. In the past 5 years, volunteers from Mennonite Disaster Services have rebuilt homes for 9 families, with more planned. But the oil spill has jeopardized the village's recovery. Residents who've been gone since Katrina are questioning whether it's worth moving back if they cannot fish the bayou.
Step out, watch your feet.
Rosina Philippe moved into her newly constructed house on stilts last August. She climbs the stairs to a simply furnished living room cooled by ceiling fans. She's pressed for time. Philippe was planning on flying to Washington, D.C. in the afternoon to impress upon Louisiana congressmen and anyone else who will listen that the oil slick threatens the very existence of her indigenous community.
Grand Bayou for us is our place in the universe. This is where, since time began, the Creator saw fit to set our feet here, and we're going to do whatever we have to do to remain.
But what can they do? The oil slick is slowly seeping toward their settlement. Fishermen say it's 35 minutes away by boat. Like other coastal communities, they don't know how long their shrimping and oystering grounds will be off limits or whether their waterways will be poisoned. But unlike other coastal communities, Grand Bayou depends on the water not just for its livelihood, but for its daily sustenance.
We've never faced this before. No matter what happened before, at the very least, we were able to feed ourselves. That's been taken away from us. That's serious. That's real serious.
This is an American community whose residents have not grown accustomed to running to the supermarket to buy ingredients for supper. As village elder Ruby Ankar says, the marsh is their provider.
One of the things my dad told me, the only thing that a Grand Bayou person needed from the grocery store was sugar, coffee, and milk.
Well, rice.
Oh, and rice, yes.
The waters of Grand Bayou have also traditionally provided recreation for the Atakapa Ishak people, who are today a mixture of Native American, Black, and Cajun. Some still speak French at home. Rosina's 18-year-old daughter, Ani, a budding environmentalist, says she never wants to leave this bayou.
Just go out in the marsh, you know, it's freedom. We were out chasing the porpoises in the boat. They were alongside the boat. You know, we were just riding with them the whole way up and down the bayou. So, I mean, stuff like that, you can't really do that anywhere else.
Though the village has dwindled in size, it has hung on despite a host of threats, violent ones like hurricanes and gradual ones like cultural dispersion. Rosina Philippe cannot imagine living anywhere else.
We are who we are because of where we are. We are Grand Bayou people. And you can't be a Grand Bayou person if you're living in Ohio.
She's going to Washington because she believes the Atakapa Ishak have to find a way to survive this latest calamity. She says she owes it to her ancestors. John Burnett, NPR News, New Orleans.
Ultra-Orthodox Jews staged a large rally today in Israel. They were protesting a decision by Israel's high court to stop religious segregation in a girls' school in the West Bank settlement of Emmanuel. The issue has brought attention to long-standing divisions in Israel's ultra-Orthodox community, including discrimination between religious groups. Shira Frankel reports from Jerusalem.
Tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox gathered in the streets of one of Jerusalem's largest avenues today. The somber scene of black hats and traditional heavy suits turned suddenly celebratory as the crowd parted to reveal several dozen men who were carried through the crowd on wooden chairs. These are the parents who have refused to send their children to a state-run school where they will study in classrooms that are mixed between Jews from different backgrounds, namely Ashkenazi, or Jews of European descent, and Sephardi, Jews who mostly identify their descent as Spanish or Middle Eastern. The ultra-Orthodox here call these parents heroes of the religious community and defend their right to segregate schools between Jews of different religious backgrounds. Rachel Menashe, a 50-year-old mother of four, says she came to the rally because she identifies with the parents.
People try to raise their children in different ways and educate them in the way that they believe. And then there are other different types of people that are educating their children differently, so they don't feel that they should be learning in the same school. And I think there's a different standard of Sephardic people over there. And I don't think I'd want my children in their company either.
Menashe says that though the distinctions between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews have become muddled among more secular Jews, the ultra-Orthodox still see those distinctions and would prefer to educate their children separately. Israel's highest court has ruled that the issue comes down to laws regarding the state-run school system. The court sentenced 41 of the Emmanuel school parents to 2 weeks in prison for contempt of court, or refusing to send their daughters to the integrated school. Emmanuel Mendelweiss says his sister is the parent of three girls at the Emmanuel school. He feels the court has ruled unfairly towards the ultra-Orthodox.
This is a group of parents that want to teach in a certain way. It is simple. My sister wants to teach the way our ancestors did, the way her parents did, and her grandparents.
But many in Israel feel that the parents in Emmanuel are still practicing a form of racism. On a street corner not far from the rally, 28-year-old Ari Holzberg held a small counter-protest. He identifies as religious, but disagrees with the ultra-Orthodox demonstrators.
I think someone who wants to study should be accepted regardless of his family condition or is the color of his skin. Think about the impression about this kid is going to grow up with, and I think it's going to make him a big racist.
As Holzberg spoke, a woman from the rally walked up and began to question him. They argued heatedly in Hebrew. The woman said he doesn't want to understand her Judaism. He responded by asking her whether she would allow her Ashkenazi daughter to marry a Sephardi boy. Absolutely not, she said. It's not even part of the issue. For NPR News, I'm Shira Frankel in Jerusalem.
Two new short story collections are out now by two gifted writers, The Spot by David Means and If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This by Robin Black. Alan Chews has our review.
Award-winning story writer David Means writes short fiction that sometimes skitters up to the borderline of legend and all the traditional rules of story making, keeping to clear beginnings, middle struggles, and sharp recognitions at the end, now and then fade into the hazy air, usually over his many Midwest locations. Means often focuses on characters who live at the lower end of the social scale and make their way in the world by hook and by crook. They're often caught up in situations, crime, drugs, adultery, that usually lend themselves in fiction to straightforward realism. Here they come drenched in lyrical intensity. Botched crimes, an amateur but deadly crucifixion of a high school boy by his friends, an office love affair, a deeply pathetic but terribly moving account of a father trying to come to terms with the possibility of his child's devastating illness. These make up the varied, sometimes bizarre, subject matter of these stories, all of them worked through in Means' distinctive style. He writes a forceful, effectively muscular sentence that gives us the minds and hearts of the characters from angles quite oblique and in rhythms often hypnotic. Now I want to tell you this about the story collection If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This by Robin Black. Just when you thought no one could write a story with any tinge of freshness, let alone originality, about childhood, Robin Black has done it in her first collection with a piece called Harriet Elliott. And just when you thought no one could write a story with any tinge of freshness, let alone originality, about marriage, Robin Black has done that in the story called Gaining Ground. Or just when you thought no one could write a story with any tinge of freshness, let alone originality, about old age, Black has done it in the story called Tableau Vivant. Her stories deliver real emotion, the kind that gives you pause and makes you wonder about, as you begin again to dive back into the pool of family life, just how much pain may be waiting for you.
The two collections of short fiction are The Spot by David Means and If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This by Robin Black. Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University. More All Things Considered right after this.
As the official start of summer nears, we are preparing to report on the summer potluck meal. You know, where everybody brings something to the table, and with any luck, it adds up to a feast.
And you can think of it as a potluck report. We're inviting you to join in. We've put a call out on Facebook for your stories about past potluck meals.
Mary Wilson Farkas writes about a high school potluck where each of the 30 or 40 teenagers who came brought only a green salad. No bread, no dressing, no serving utensils. Just salad.
And Frances Nicholson was at a July 4th potluck where every dish had to be colored red, white, and blue.
Of course.
So one person brought a combination of red peppers, marshmallows, and toothpaste.
Of course. You can find more stories at Morning Edition's Facebook page, and please, by all means, add your own. Just make sure to bring more than salad.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. Food body, food body, food body, food body.